Well, right now on the street, you have a difference of opinion among people, but for the most part, people are happy that the initiative, that the assault on Gaza went ahead. They don't feel that it was a massive success, but they're glad that it happened. Some people regret that it didn't happen for longer or that it wasn't more extensive. But the Prime Minister managed to frighten enough ministers to back away from that position. But the Israeli street is thoroughly behind the results. In terms of going to Cairo, I think that people just want quiet, in the sense that when you ask Israelis about what kind of solution they want to conflict with the Palestinians, they'll often say, give lip service to saying they want a two-state solution. And some people take this as a sign of longing for peace. And the problem is that there's no effort to parse what kind of two-state solution they want. What most or a large plurality of Israelis want is a separation, but they don't necessarily want to give concessions that are realistic, that a majority of Palestinian people would be satisfied with. So they want the separation, but they don't want to make the concessions. And so Israelis are demanding a demilitarized Palestine. That's something that Palestinians can't accept, being the victims of assaults every couple of years. I don't think any Palestinian government is going to agree to that, at least willingly. So there's a huge gap between what the Israeli street expects its leaders to demand and what the Palestinian people would be willing to give up in negotiations. It's hard to imagine that they can come to some kind of agreement there.
The bombing and shelling of Gaza sparked protests around the world calling for this ceasefire and, in fact, for an ongoing and permanent cessation of hostilities. What was the climate like for pro-peace voices within Israel?
Well, in the last several years, there have been several assaults either on Gaza or on Lebanon, and I've witnessed peace rallies or anti-war rallies in different cities in Israel. And there's always been, at least in the last decade that I can recall, there's always been, antagonism towards people who do this. And a lot of people just walking by observing won't just casually turn their heads and shrug their shoulders. They'll scream and they'll yell and they'll swear and, wish death or wish rape upon the people who are protesting. That's not uncommon. But we've really seen how that has stepped up in this conflict. Whereas before, at most, you have people cursing and shouting and maybe some shoving matches, but now you have full-on assaults where people organize in advance, whether it's on social networks or in their, in local communities, come out with, makeshift weapons, if it's sticks or whatever hard objects, and actually assault protesters. The police don't really do all that much to prevent that from happening. It's actually quite scary for many people to protest. That's on one front. On the other front, even just to speak, not even necessarily to put your body on the line, but even to speak openly, whether it's on social media, doing a Facebook status, or in your at the cooler at the office, people are very frightened to say anything against the war because there is so much groupthink around this, and some people have been fired from their jobs already, or their jobs have been threatened, that they would lose their jobs if they make such statements. So the Israeli left has been on the run, on the decline for several years now, but we've really seen that, full throttled, McCarthyism in the last several days, in the last month.
Now, as that Israeli left has quieted, has been on the run, as you say, in recent times, during this most recent military campaign, a few high-profile Israeli voices made some controversial statements. Some say constitute calls for genocide. Israeli Knesset member Ayelet Shaked has called the entire Palestinian people the enemy, and said that Palestinian mothers should be killed and their homes demolished so that they cannot raise more, quote, little snakes. The Times of Israel also published an opinion piece called When Genocide is Permissible, which was later deleted. Are these strictly fringe voices, or are these calls resonating with mainstream Israelis as well?
Well, what you now quoted me is things that I would hear on the streets of Israel, you know, just casually as you're walking down the street. And I made this point when I did a search on Twitter for the word Arabs in Hebrew and just found, you know, comment after comment of people saying death to the Arabs, death to the Arabs. But that's just for people who aren't living here. If you're living here, it's quite easy to just walk down the street and hear the discourse. It's not uncommon for people to say stuff like that. Now, what's the only difference is that now people who think this way have been so emboldened that they feel comfortable saying so even publicly, even in newspapers, even on Facebook, even in English. So Ayelet Shaked is not a marginal figure at all. She's a rising star. She's a young politician, one of the youngest in the Knesset, and she's the whip of her faction of the government. So clearly it's not a marginal voice. You also have the deputy speaker of the Knesset publishing an article just this week calling for concentration camps to be established in Gaza for the Palestinian population to be ethnically cleansed out into Egypt and for Jewish settlers to be, for the entire Gaza Strip to be populated with Jews. So, and I can go on and on and on. There's so many examples of this. The head of the largest Jewish religious youth group in the world, called Bnei Akiva, the head of it wrote that not only should Palestinians be murdered, but that their foreskins should be scalped and taken as trophies. And there's just comment after comment. These are not marginal figures. And this is the discourse in Israel. And as you pointed out, there's an article in Times of Israel, but another article published the same day was not retracted and called for the same thing. And another article the other day, two articles in Ynet in the last week, again, calling for ethnic cleansing and genocide and saying that civilians are, you know, open season, essentially. A civilian is not a civilian, and it's okay to kill them. So, and then what's even perhaps even more frightening, the next step is that this discourse is migrating to the United States. So you have leaders of the Jewish community in the United States, where before at least paid lip service, even if they, you know, fully backed Israel's military adventures, so to speak, at least there was this lip service to, you know, but we condemn killing of, you know, loss of life on all sides. There was at least an effort to have a liberal face. But now you have voices in the Jewish community. For example, the president of the New York Board of Rabbis coming out at a pro-Israel rally and saying the same thing, that civilians aren't civilians, and therefore, you know, it's okay to kill them because they're not civilians. And the same thing with Thane Rosenbaum, who is the leading candidate to become the next national director of the Anti-Defamation League. Again, saying the same thing in an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple weeks ago. So this level of discourse in which calls to genocide, calls to ethnic cleansing, calls to murder civilians have long been heard on the Israeli street, have long been heard on social media, increasingly heard at the top levels of government in the last few years in Hebrew, now even being made in English, and even by some of the American Jewish, established mainstream American Jewish leadership. And that's what's even more frightening is that instead of being embarrassed by these calls to ethnic cleansing by their Israeli co-religionists, they actually join in the chorus.
David Sheen, in a recent post on Mondo Weiss, you documented a trending call in social media to violence against Arabs made by pre-army service-aged teens. Tell us about that and what that means for a military staffed with a policy of compulsory service.
Well, American media has long held Israeli society with kid gloves and not treated the burgeoning racism in Israeli society with any seriousness, not given it any attention. Just in last month, when all of a sudden you had this lynching of the Palestinian teenager Mohammed Al-Khder, where he was kidnapped outside his own home, taken to a forest, beaten, gasoline forced down his throat, and he was torched from the inside out. So when you have this such a horrific act, then for the really just a little bit of a conversation in the American media, people had to relate to this. How could this happen? Where is all this hate coming from? And predictably, you had some knee-jerk columnists saying, oh no, this is marginal, this is football hooligans, you know. And there's no question, Israel has its fair share of football hooligans, but to act as if the sheer, the raw racism towards Palestinian people, towards African people, towards non-Jews in general in Israeli society is somehow only restricted to young adolescent males, that is completely off base. And you know, I didn't go in there with an agenda. I just simply did a search on Twitter, and it just happened to turn out that way. I didn't cherry pick them, but a large majority of, I mean, there were some young men, but a large majority of the people saying death to the Arabs, kill all the Arabs, and variants on that were women, were young teenage girls. Also in a recent article, Gidon Levy of Haaretz also found the same thing when he did a survey of online media. He also found that a lot of the people who were making these statements loudest were women. I can't really explain why that is, but it's a symbol of how common it is in society, of how prevalent it is. And yeah, just to speak to the fact that they are entering the army in a couple of years, you would think that this would be something that would frighten the Israeli government, or at least the education ministry, who is responsible for their education. And last year, again, when there was another horrific beating of a Palestinian man, just a random racist beating, and a slew of them, there was an effort by some left-wing parties in the Knesset to legislate a law that would just mandate 1 hour a week of anti-racist education, nothing more, just 1 hour a week to teach tolerance in the schools, realizing that this is a problem. The government voted it down. And it wasn't just the right-wing factions, it was the so-called centrist factions of the government as well. So if even 1 hour a week is too much, the situation you have is teachers are afraid to speak about human rights in the classroom. And this has been documented by Or Kashti, who's the educational correspondent to Haaretz. I keep citing it because it's really, his work is really important, where, you know, he'll talk to teachers and they'll say, we are afraid to bring up the topic of human rights and civil rights. It's mandated. We have to teach it. We have civics classes, but we're afraid to bring it up because when we do, the students, many of, not all of them, but many of them become so incensed and enraged and start spewing racist hatred that it just, the classroom turns into a farce, and we're actually afraid. So we curtail all of our discussion of human rights and civil rights. So if that's the situation in Israel, where teachers are even afraid to bring up the very concept of human rights, I mean, what does that say for society? What does it say for these youth who, as you pointed out, in just a couple of years are going to be putting on, you know, olive uniforms and picking up submachine guns and using them in some cases? So that doesn't bode very well for Israeli society. And if you look statistically over the last couple of decades, it's not just that they're racist today. If you look at statistics, over half of Israeli youth say they don't believe Arab citizens of Israel should have equal rights. You go back 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20 years, what's scariest is it's getting worse. It's not just that they're racist, but over time, every few years, more and more, greater and greater percentages of Israeli youth are making these statements. And frankly, that's what's most frightening.
David Sheen, clothed in the fabric of this Israeli society that you described to us, and the fabric of a Palestinian youth who has grown up under conditions of occupation, are mediators who are negotiating some sort of ceasefire or perhaps even a long-term solution or a cessation of hostilities. Where can that possibly go from here?
I'll be honest with you. I don't have a lot of hope, because if you look at who the mediators are, you know, the United States has essentially been the exclusive mediator of talks between Israelis and Palestinians. But the United States is not a neutral mediator. It has consistently been arming the Israeli government, and, you know, to the tune of several billion dollars a year, and President Obama just signed an extra several hundred million onto that. And all along, it's protected it in the United Nations by stopping UN votes that move to censure Israel for its assaults. So you can't really look to the United States as some kind of honest broker here. So in that case, really, Palestinians have no choice but to capitulate. If you speak to Palestinians on the ground in the West Bank, just about everyone that I speak to says that they see the Palestinian Authority as a collaborator regime, as enforcing the occupation for the Israeli government just at a cheaper cost to Israeli society. So instead of directly policing Palestinians and curtailing their freedom, it's Palestinian police that are doing it. I don't really see any way for Palestinians to have leverage. You know, for the last several years, they've consistently had non-armed, because people sometimes throw stones, but consistently it's been, you know, people marching to the wall and demanding, in a non-armed fashion, demanding their rights, demanding freedom of movement, demanding that their lands not be confiscated, et cetera, et cetera. And when people say, where is this Palestinian Gandhi? Well, he's been sitting in an Israeli, there are many of them sitting in Israeli jails, because whenever a Palestinian people organize amongst themselves to nonviolently protest the occupation of their lives, Israeli government responds not by negotiating to grant them that freedom that every human being deserves, but instead, you know, incarcerates them. So really, what choice do the Palestinian people have? The way I see it, they don't have any leverage. They've tried peaceful negotiations. They haven't resulted in anything. They've tried protests. That hasn't resulted. There have been military factions like the Hamas that have, you know, engaged in armed resistance. That hasn't amounted to anything, obviously. So what possible choice they can have? It looks like the Israeli government just wants to continue the status quo, to slowly, slowly annex these territories, but not come out and say it, because that would be a faux pas. So it just does it slowly by making lives miserable for Palestinians there, without any avenue out. Palestinians are grumbling to themselves, but short of America withdrawing its support of Israel, and based on the domestic alignment of U.S. politics, I have a hard time imagining that that's going to happen. I don't see any way for the negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians to result in any kind of solution that would amount to one that Palestinian people could accept.
That was independent journalist and award-winning filmmaker David Sheen. He joined us from his home in Dimona, Israel. You can find him on Twitter @DavidSheen. For FSRN, I'm Nell Abram.